My name is Dr. Austin Tay. Welcome to In Conversation. This segment is brought to you by the Division of Industrial Organizational Psychology. We are very delighted today to have with us Professor Kenneth Law, a professor in Department of Management and the Associate Dean Research at the Chinese University of Hong Kong Business School. Hi there, Kenneth. How are you?
Hi, I'm good. How's everything for you?
Not too bad. Thank you. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us today. I was just wondering whether maybe you could briefly describe, introduce to us what you do and your career.
Okay. Try to make it brief. I graduated from the University of Iowa, or it's more almost 30 years by now. And after graduation, I went to the Australian Graduate School of Management and touched in the MBA program for about 3 years. Mm-hmm. And then I came back to Hong Kong and served as an assistant professor in HKUST, the Hong Kong University of Science and Technology, for 13 years. And then in 2007, CEO called me, and I still remember the pro VP during that time. The first thing he said when he called me is that, "Kenny, you are our graduates, and right now we need you." So I get back to see you simply because of that.
Ah, I see. So now you are now the Associate Dean for Research. What is the role there? Maybe you could talk a little bit more about what you do there.
Okay. Basically, I'm responsible for all the research-related issues right here. And basically, you can say that it mainly covers two major areas. The first one is responsible for the research program. So anything related to PhD and MPhil students right here is under my control. And also I'm responsible for the research of all the faculty members right here. So anything related to grant applications, their publication every year, what kind of research they do, et cetera, et cetera. So those are my job scopes right here.
Right, so a very busy role that you have here in the Chinese U. I was just wondering, I mean, you are also a very prolific researcher. You've done a lot of research in your name and also with your colleagues. Maybe tell us a little bit more of some of your current research projects that you're doing.
Okay. As I told you guys last time, basically I am up to the stage right now that I am not doing my research. I'm helping my students and my past graduate students to do their research. So basically I'm helping them. There are a number of projects that I'm doing right now. For example, there is one on moral licensing of CEOs. Mm-hmm. So we are using the moral licensing arguments to argue that CEOs actually undergo the process of moral licensing and moral cleansing when they make donations and possible commit violations in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. So this is one project I'm working with one of my students in Nanjing University. And also another student in Guangzhou, we are working on the issue of litter prototypicality. I don't know whether you are familiar with the topic.
No, not at all. Do tell us a bit more about that.
Boy, this term is difficult to pronounce. Litter prototypicality.
Okay.
A prototypical leader is a leader that possessed the most important characteristics of a team.
Ah, okay.
So basically, the general argument is that all the team members, they have some kind of perception of what kind of team we are, what are our characteristics, etc. And if a leader possesses the core characteristics of team, we call this leader a prototypical leader.
Prototypical leader. Mm.
Yeah. So this topic is on the issue of leader prototypicality, and study its effect on some team dynamics. So it's, for example, how committed are the members to the team and how are they going to interact with other teams through this process of, through this construct of leader prototypicality based on the theory of social identification. So the general argument is pretty straightforward. If team members see that their leaders are prototypical, they would have strong identification. So internally, they would be very productive and cohesive, and externally, they would see all the others as outside group members and commit some kind of an intergroup conflicts. So this is the second study. Mm-hmm. We also work on a project with one of my graduate students now serving in CTU in Hong Kong. on paradoxical leadership,
yes.
A new type of leadership style, looking from the yin-yang concept of paradoxical leadership. We argue that this is very important for innovation management. And through the process of construct we call ambidexterity, and paradoxical leaders can actually stimulate innovation process both at the team level and individual levels. And we also study the effect of employees' performance on supervisors' emotions and how they affect their interaction with the students, with another student of mine who is teaching in Lingnan University right now.
Mm.
Other than that, there is one project which is actually out of my own, the grants that I get last year from the Hong Kong government on the nature of mindfulness training and how it affects the outcomes of the trainees. Basically, we are trying to explore what has happened during the process of mindfulness training and why would mindfulness can achieve the kind of objective they're looking for.
Mm. Those are very, very typical topics that you're doing. I mean, although some of them are very, very wide and very, and by the sound of the topics that you're talking about, they were quite grand in the way it has been described. But I think they're also very relevant to the society today, to the work environment today. I mean, it's very interesting. I mean, you're talking about paradoxical leadership, which is one of those trends that people were talking about maybe 2 years ago, and prototypical leadership, which is something that's very new, but I think it's so much interest in there. And of course, lastly, you're talking about, you know, the mindfulness training, and especially now where all of us are going through a very unprecedented times, where all of us are working from home. Mindfulness is one of those things that we need to have to help us to manage our emotions and also the way we think and the way we feel, I guess, in the workplace. So I think those are very, very fantastic research you are doing, which, you know, I wish that we could have more time to talk to you. Maybe in another time we can arrange to talk one of those subjects that you are researching. It, definitely in terms of mindfulness, is one thing that I personally is also I'm very interested, because I focus a little bit on the acceptance and commitment therapy. So mindfulness is one of those components, and it will be interesting to hear your thoughts on that. But of course, today we are very focused on one particular research that you have been doing. When we got that information from you, we were trying to figure out how to have this conversation, because, and then when we thought about it, it could be actually quite relevant at this present moment, talking about underemployment, isn't it? So I'm just wondering, you know, what are the antecedents and consequences of underemployment in terms of your perspective?
Okay. Up to now, we do not know too much about the antecedents of, by the way, underemployment. I think we are focusing on a specific area of underemployment, what they call over-education. And I think this is the commonest problem of underemployment nowadays.
Mm.
Underemployment basically means that you are overqualified to the job. And you can be overqualified in a whole lot of different sense. And we are focusing on over-education simply because this is the prevailing phenomenon right now, both in Hong Kong, mainland China, and Taiwan. up to now, we do not, based on my understanding, we do not know that much about over-education. That means, why would people be over-educated?
Mm.
The only reason I can think of right now, it may be sociological. It's because a lot of time, both in Taiwan and in especially in mainland China, for the students, if they cannot find the kind of expected job they have after they graduate, they will continue their study. And then at the end, after they graduated from the master program, maybe it may not help them to find a quote better job. So in that sense, they would become overeducated because they're doing more or less the same kind of job, but they are more qualified for the job.
Mm.
So that's the only antecedent I can think of. In terms of outcome, there are from the literature, we can see that there are two major outcomes. Basically, in the economics literature, the first one is that we are pretty sure that those who are overeducated are high performers because of their overeducation. So they are overtrained for their jobs. So the performance is good. However, most of the economists, they do not like this idea of over-education and would recommend that managers do not hire that kind of people because the general argument is that the employees would not stay on their job for too long.
Right. So kind of motivation issue will come up from there, isn't it?
And this is actually the motivation for us to do the research because this is not what we have observed in the reality. And in mainland China, we have seen a whole lot of cases of over-education and the employees may not leave the firm at all. It may not mean that they're working unhappily, they feel that they are underutilized or things like that. It may not be the case. And since because we see that kind of special phenomenon, and that's why we start this particular research.
And from what you just said, I was just thinking, as you say, social issues also. When someone who is over-educated and they eventually find a job, as what you said, the economists will say, don't employ them because they will leave because of their motivation. But I think in these present times, where we are today in the VUCA world, finding a job and getting a job is actually a blessing. You know, and if you are able to hold on to the job, you want to hold on to as long as possible. Because you never know when is the next job coming, and when you are asked to leave is also a very sad thing to deal with. So I think I quite agree with you that you know what you have now initially found that people are not leaving because of the fact that they are overly educated or over educated. On the contrary, they want to stay. And perhaps also this is it very synonymous of the kind of perhaps the generation that we have now. Because we used to talk about Generation X, Y, and then we have the millennials who will kind of stay for 2 years and go. But I think this is like this Generation Z, where people, are a little, I mean, this generation is a bit different, I think. Is that what you have found? Is this what I'm gathering from what you're saying?
Personally, I would say that it may not be directly related to the social unrest in Hong Kong last year and also the pandemics that we are facing right now. It has happened in mainland China for many years already. And in Taiwan, it's also very obvious. Hong Kong may be a little bit better as compared with Taiwan and China. But still, it's very common that they said that the university graduates in Hong Kong right now is comparable to a secondary school students in the past. So it's a very general phenomenon, not specific to our situation right now. I would say that the major problem we have seen at the very beginning is that the economists look at this problem from an economic point of view.
Sure.
And we as psychologists, that's why we look at the problem from a psychological point of view. And if you look at this issue of over-education or underemployment from a psychological point of view, it would be completely different. Because as we keep on teaching our students in the area of human resource management, what keeps the employees inside the organization? Of course, money is an important concern, prospect is an important concern, but what kind of organization it is, what is your vision, and the kind of colleagues they have right here. For example, right now we keep on talking about job embeddedness and that kind of concept. So there are a whole lot of some other factors, for example, whether you like your customers, when you're teaching in the school, whether you like the students, et cetera, et cetera. So these are all other factors which would affect whether the employees would like to continue to stay in this organization. So the real question is not whether you would leave when you feel that you're overeducated. The question is, what would you do if you feel that you're overeducated and you do not want to leave?
Yep.
So this is the underlying impulse for us to doing this particular research.
So with your research that you've just found, I mean, some initial findings, do you see that people are doing something very unusual, as what you just said? How would you want to stay? You know, it's not because of overly educated. What are the things that will pull you back? Maybe the opportunity, as you said, the team members, the way the culture of the organization is, that could be also factors to encourage people to stay on, because they probably see it is also a opportunity to learn more things. Because having that mindset of, you know, I've been learning throughout all these years without finding a job, now I get a job, I still want to carry on learning. I think that mentality of wanting to learn and hoping to learn more things in a job would also be a factor to make them stay and try their best to get their job done well so that they wouldn't be asked to go.
Yeah, of course. And I think I want to highlight a point which is very important in human resource management nowadays. In the past, we always try to think of jobs as well-defined. So we have the topic of job design. How are you going to design your job so that employees would have work happily and with high motivation? But right now, I think more than 10 years ago, we have changed the mindset completely. Right now, most of the organizations, we call them boundaryless organizations. They do not have a fixed boundary of what kind of job they would do. And within the organization, the task being responsible for different positions may be completely different. So employees have some kind of a role in the process of changing the job nature and making the job challenging to them and contribute more to the organization. And if we look at the job design from this point of view, and in fact, one major scholars who contributed to this area recently is Adam Grant in the United States. He actually add in what he called a social component of job design. So right now, when we jobs are not mechanistic and dead things out there that cannot be changed. Mm. We are the job holder, and we can actually change the nature of the job. Yes. The special term used in our field is called job crafting. So we are crafters who can actually craft our jobs. And there are, theoretically, there are three different dimensions of job crafting. We can craft our job in terms of the tasks we do. Mm-hmm. So the nature of the job cover different tasks. We can craft the relational element of the job. So we interact with different types of people. We can also craft our job cognitively. So to think about the meaning, the actual meaning of the job to the whole society or to the people around us. Mm-hmm. So we call them task crafting, relational crafting, and cognitive crafting. So this particular project, actually we use the idea of job crafting to explain why, what would the overeducated employees do within the organization. They would actually craft their job to make their job fit into their actual capability. Mm. However, the difference cannot be too big. So if, for example, you got a PhD degree and ask you to clean the toilet, there's no way that you can craft your job. Yeah. So that's why the relationship is a curvilinear one. So long as it's not, the difference is not too big, it will help us to craft our job and make the job fit to us and contribute more to the organization. Mm. Once you pass this maximum threshold, it will start to drop. So in that sense, over-education is bad. So it depends on which side of the inverted parabola you're talking about.
Yes. And I think it's interesting you're saying about now the onus is on the person doing the job. Because we have always been living in a life where you see a lot of HR people are tasked to come up with the job description, or they would work with the line managers, the job description. And they will be feeling so helpless because the job description that has been created by the line managers or all their managers given to the HR has to go out and find someone that supposedly fit into this. But yeah. This is such a kind of a false fit, isn't it? Because this fit itself doesn't really tell you a lot of the person's capability. And in what you were saying, in the context of someone who is very educated, they might bring a different perspective to the role, to the job. And especially where the role and the job of yesteryears is no longer applicable to times of today where things are changing. And I also like the fact that you were saying, you know, one of the things about how the job crafting is so important is about relationship. Because organization has always been talking about we need to train people to have XYZ skills, leadership skills, cross-functional skills. But why don't we look at the most fundamental thing, the job itself? If we can create something like that, give the ownership and also the autonomy to the person who is doing the job, then it makes more sense. And then in terms of organizational growth, it will also make more sense. And I think what you share is so interesting because your research is going to tell a lot of organizations to rethink about how they are crafting jobs, how they are actually sending out their job description for recruitment. Because we are seeing a lot of high levels of recruitment resources, but then they're getting all the wrong people in. 6 months down the road, they're spending more money to recruit again. And I think this is one thing that people who are in the HR space or organizations should be thinking about it. And I think your research will be such a good breath of fresh air to them and let them understand what it is that they need to do.
In fact, this is from my point of view, this is a general trend of a whole lot of high performing organizations in the world. You think about, for example, we use Google as an example. They are not thinking about hiring a programmer or some kind of person. They only hire the best person from the market. And after you get in, you try to think with us and explore with us what kind of new market we have, what kind of new jobs we can create that fits you and fit the organization's progress as well. So in that kind of highly volatile environment, especially for the high-tech companies, this is the kind of HR model that has been used for many years already. I can give you a very good example that I have heard of. For example, we keep on thinking about accountants as people who care about the detail mining of all the data and put the number here and there, right? As an accountant, the person can do quite different things, but he or she can still be a very successful accountant. He or she may be a very good interpersonal skill and set up good relationship with their customers, and then outsource the whole accounting job to India or some other country and let them do the mechanistic part. So we have some kind of a very fixed view of jobs and what employees should do in the past, instead of giving them the kind of innovative environment so that they can grow together with the organization. And I think from an HR point of view, this is very important.
I think that is one thing, a different take on the work with growth. Rather than just making people do repetitive work, you need to actually work with them and come up with the next level of innovation, the next thing that you want to do for your organization. I'm coming back to the fact that you were talking about job crafting itself. Now, trying to link it back to what we were talking about earlier on underemployment. How do you think, job crafting is related to underemployment?
As I said, in the parabolic relationship, when your underemployment is not very serious, it's only a little bit, which is the reality most of the time. If you got a PhD, as I said, you will not go to clean the toilets, right? So if the underemployment is not too serious, most of the time, most of the employees will try to change the nature of the job, craft their job. For example, if I got a master's degree and I go to teach in a high school or secondary school, I'm overqualified from that definition. And I would try to use my education to teach the student in a totally different way. So on the positive side of underemployment, when you are on the positive slope, you would try to craft your job and make your job fit to your education environment. Unless you come to the point that you cannot do anything else because of the organizational constraint, personal constraint, et cetera, et cetera. And then you go to the downward slope.
I mean, that's fantastic to see it from the perspective of the person who is doing the job. What if in society like Hong Kong and maybe in China and also in Taiwan, where opportunities are very, very scarce, where people are just going to kind of recruit people or organizations going to recruit individuals who they think fit into their traditional mold. Even though someone who is, like for example, for myself, is someone like me who has a master's degree, but I want to do the job, I can't because first hurdle is the organization see me as a threat or someone who's overly qualified. So that I'm not going to give an opportunity very much that I love to be crafting it. So how then what kind of advice will you give someone like me to say, well, what should I do in terms of able to craft my job, but then at the same time to be able to get employed in a society like maybe Hong Kong, China, or Taiwan?
I think it's not the employee themselves I think we should start with the organization. It is how HR will view the management process of the organization. So we need to give employees more freedom and innovative spaces, so that they can actually find the best way to do their job. We only tell them what we want at the end, okay? So employees are actually partners. Right now, the HR view is that they are not employees for the organization, they are partners and working together with the organization to achieve the organization's goal. So long as we provide that kind of autonomous background for the employees so that they can actually change the job in order to achieve the organizational goals, they would do that. This is the general assumption of psychology. People want their self-concept to increase. And if you give them the kind of environment, they would do it automatically. So long as you hire the good person.
Good person, yes. I mean, on the other side then, how would you, basing on what you have researched, you know, you found out, advise an organization to open up, you know, to kind of start thinking about underemployment and job crafting?
First, use more the more up-to-date leadership styles, like paradoxical leadership, paradoxical leadership, transformational leadership, and that kind of stuff. Basically, the job of a leader is to set the vision for the group, not to tell the employees what to do, because the employees would know what to do if they're qualified for the job. They would actually, they know more about the job than the supervisor themselves. So they are the one who actually explore how the job should be done. And other than setting up a more autonomous background, I think a very important point is the moderator we find in this study. It is the identification of the employees. Whether employees actually identify with the firms and think that we are part of this organization. And I'm happy to work with you to promote this organization and promote the well-being of the organization. So very important is that the CEO or the top executive, so that the kind of vision in a transformational sense, that actually the employees like your direction. This is the direction for us to go, and they would be happy to grow together with the organization. Sorry. What I have seen in the United States is that there are some firms which they describe their organization in a very interesting way. They actually using the concept of partnership. So in the past, I am the boss and I hire you. You come and work for me. Of course, you have to work according to my will. Right now, they're not doing it this way. They are actually thinking of partners. So my job is to develop you so that you would become my partner in the future. Partner in the sense of not just working inside my organization as my employee, but at the end, I would encourage you to solve the problem in your particular area in an innovative way so that you can spin off and start a company and serve as our outsourcing company in the future. So you will become a boss in the future and work with us together.
That is a very interesting concept. Do you think Asia will catch up?
Don't know. Especially depending on how you define the word Asia. If you're talking about private enterprise in China, I think still a long way to go. Hong Kong may be a little bit better. Taiwan is still lagging behind. So we do not have the kind of concept. We keep on thinking that I'm the boss, you're serving me, I pay you. So you have to do according to what I want. And for that kind of management mindset, it's very difficult to motivate the employees because, okay, you're my boss, you tell me what to do, I do according to what you say. And they cannot have creativity or innovation in the transformation process.
Yeah. And I think you're right to say start from organization. But I think at the same time, we also need to start talking to younger people that they need to take charge of their work and their path and career rather than going to a job just because they are being asked by their parents to be an accountant, a lawyer or what have you, and not really think. Because I think a lot of, as you say, people want to be part of an organization, to feel that they are part of an organization. They can be motivated. They can be inspired by the leaders. But they need to be, as what you said, a partner, to be willing to take the step as a partner, not just having that very traditional view of I'm a paid employee, I will do whatever my boss said, but then not coming up with innovation, coming up with their own opinions and ideas. And I think this is where perhaps maybe being in Asia, we are a little bit different because of the culture itself. We have always been believing that, you know, if you are too individualistic or you being different in an organization, you will become a sore thumb, really. But I think this is where organization and potential workers all need to understand that this is how the organization or this is how the business world is going to evolve, because we can't be staying put with traditions and with work practices that were 20 years, 30 years behind. We need to move on because all of us are working in such a fast pace and so internationally, we all need to start adopting the status quo, I guess, the norm for working and not be kind of lagging behind here in Asia. But I think that is very important.
I think it's in a broader sense, it's also related to our education system. The way we train our youngsters in the school, are we training them and fit them with knowledge, or are we encouraging them to think out of the box and trying to come up with creative answer? And as I said, China right now is still in the stage of imitating what's happening in the West, simply because of that kind of a mindset. So we have to turn it upside down. Otherwise, it's very difficult for us to be competitive in the future.
Yeah, so I guess your job is also very, very tough, because you need to make sure you are innovative. You're able to kind of spur the kind of ideas in your students, because it's very difficult. And I agree with you, the education system, you know, sometimes I feel that the education system is set for all of us to fail, because we just memorize things and then we just do things and then sort of just get a pass mark. But I think it's very important to let people understand that the big white world is not like in the classroom. It's very different. We need to bring real issues and real things to the classroom, teach them, and as they go out, they're more prepared to face the challenges in the world. Just very much like, you know, you were saying, in Hong Kong or in Taiwan and even China, we are still perhaps in the very embryonic stage of imitating what has been done successfully in the West. We have not actually kind of stepped up from that. I think there's a lot more for us to look at and learn and research, like what you are doing will be very, very helpful for a lot of us and practitioners and Thank also you. Students as well. One last question, perhaps, Kenneth. Well, given the economy now, we all know is not moving, and we are expecting there's going to be a lot of turbulence in the world. What are some of your tips for people who are, to deal with underemployment better, in a sense? Because I know there's a lot of graduates all coming out this year, next year, or maybe last year, having this big question mark in their head. How do I go and find a job? And, you know, how do I be competitive
market? We can look at this issue from two ways. The first one is from the job seeker's point of view. I think this is what you keep on asking, which I'm not well prepared, because I teach management how to do instead of job seekers how to do. Well, from their point of view, I think the most important point from an HR point of view, in fact, there are more and more HR managers who would like that kind of people. We want proactive employees. Mm. So show to the HR guys that I am a proactive person and I know what's happening in your firm, and I would do it in a different way. Mm. In fact, my son is looking for a job in the IT field in the last few months. Luckily, he got one recently. He told me that in almost all the interviews, the HR managers are actually putting a factual problem that they're facing right now, push it to the job seeker and ask them, if you were our employee, how are you going to solve that problem? So we need problem solvers nowadays. We do not need doers, we need thinkers. Mm. So they have to show to the HR managers that I understand your business and I know I have some idea of how to deal with that. And this needs training.
Mm. Mm.
This is, so from the job seeker's point of view, this is what I would suggest. And from the recruiter's point of view, I think I'm still using the HR model that I learned in my PhD program. My advisor, in fact, is a very, I don't know whether I should use the word extreme, but at least he has a lot of enemies in the academic world simply because of what he proposed. He keep on saying that we should only hire the best in the market. And even though they leave the organization after 1 year, you gain in this 1 year process. Now I change his saying a little bit. If you hire the best people from the market, if they leave your organization, it is not their fault. It is your fault as a manager, because you cannot keep them. If the organization is well managed, and if the organization can actually have a prospect, and if they know that they can play a role in this growing process, I cannot see why would they leave the organization. For anyone entering Google right now, even you kick them out, they would not like to leave the organization at all, because they like the organization so much. Mm-hmm. So hire the best people in the market, hire the smartest people in the market, and grow with them. And this is what I would suggest to the organizations.
Great. Good. On that good note, you have given us, I think, our listeners very good advice, those who are seeking jobs and also those who are probably listening as organization to start thinking about how they should rethink about their recruitment drive and how they should be crafting their job. With yes. that, I thank you for your time for talking to us, and I hope we get a chance to talk to you again.
Sure.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.